Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Building a Climate Ready New England conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I'll now turn the call over to Deanna Moran to begin.
Hi everyone, thank you for joining us on the phone and through Facebook Live. This winter in New England, we've witnessed a lot of extreme weather events, most recently with a bomb cyclone earlier this month, a lunar eclipse, and several other events which have caused flooding in many of our communities. It's become clear that extreme weather is not just in our future, it's happening right now. And this marks today's discussion all the more relevant. Is New England climate ready? My name is Deanna Moran. I'm the Director of Environmental Planning at the Conservation Law Foundation. Joining me for this discussion is Elena Mahaly, a staff attorney at CLF and co-author of CLF's recently released report, Climate Adaptation and Liability, and Isaac Hodes, who is the Director of Lynn United for Change Empowerment Project. I just want to remind people that they'll have an opportunity to ask questions and make comments by posting on Facebook Live or pressing star one on their phone. So let's start the discussion by talking about some of the recent extreme weather events that we've experienced. Isaac, can you talk a little bit about how flooding has impacted your community?
Sure. Hearing a lot of people in Lynn talk about this recent set of events as some of the worst flooding they've seen since the blizzard of 78. And, you know, it's part of a pattern recently. We've been seeing a lot of flooding of homes, huge amount of damage. To homes, to cars, streets were flooded this recent episode more seriously and further along than they have been in a long time or possibly ever. So I think it was really bad, and it's part of this pattern we're seeing.
And from a climate perspective, do you think that this has been like an eye-opening experience for people who may have been skeptical about increases in weather impact?
I think so. I think it builds little by little, and people are becoming a lot more aware of, you know, these impacts being very immediate and very real, and, you know, not something halfway across the world. Absolutely.
And how has the recent development in Lynn, I know there's been a lot of project proposals and new development, how is that impacting the waterfront, or how are developers taking into consideration this increase in flooding?
Sure. Like you mentioned, a lot of the new development that's projected in Lynn is going to be right on the waterfront. And I think in general what we're seeing is that, you know, unless developers are really pushed, they're kind of trying to get away with doing the bare minimum that's required under regulations and not fully taking into account the impacts of sea level rise, of more frequent severe weather events due to climate change, et cetera. And I think that really kind of intersects with some of the economic justice issues we're concerned with. For example, one of the big new developments seems to be designed at this point in a way that the living facilities probably are reasonably well protected against climate change. Most of the residents are going to be very wealthy, high-income folks. The public access areas that are required by law are lower lying and seem like they won't be as well protected, and, you know, eventually that could erode public access to the waterfront because of the impact of increased flooding. So we just really see a need to be carefully monitoring that and really pushing developers to do more to project into the future.
Great. And Elena, can you tell us a little bit about the report that CLF released yesterday about climate adaptation and liability? Seems like that report might address or kind of speak to some of the issues that Isaac's talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So that report summarizes about a year's worth of work that CLF has been doing to look into this issue. Exactly as you said, Isaac, oftentimes developers, unless they're pushed, are really just going to design to whatever the building code requires. And what we know is that these climate impacts are certainties. And a lot of times the codes are backwards looking instead of forward looking, and they don't maybe contemplate the sea level rise or the flooding. And so if we're just designing to the minimum, then we're not going to design safe buildings. And so CLF started looking into what are the legal liabilities of making those kinds of choices and failing to perhaps adapt sufficiently your buildings to what we know are the climate impacts that are imminent and here today.
Great. And how would you define climate resilience?
It's broadly speaking the ability of a system to absorb impacts from climate change and to continue to function in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And when I say system, I think here we're talking about the built environment system, our natural environment system, and also the social fabric of communities to be able to withstand climate impacts and still thrive. Mm-hmm.
And Isaac, from the community perspective, what do you feel like the people in Lynn define as climate resilience or think about when they think about climate resiliency? And what, if anything, are they asking of from their public officials and elected officials on this?
I think it's hard to kind of abstract that from the other issues we're dealing with. They're really intertwined. So Lynn is undergoing a housing crisis at this point where, you know, affordability is disappearing. So I think, you know, the kind of displacement we're starting to see is very much connected to, you know, issues related to climate justice, you know, where we're going to need to account for, you know, going forward, what impact is this going to have? You know, just recently, the City Housing Authority acquired some previously vacant land from General Electric. It just happens to be, you know, right on a area very prone to flooding, and they're considering putting housing there. We certainly will be pushing for that to accommodate lower income people, but we need to figure out how does that interact with the flooding risk and with, you know, climate issues. You know, how is that, you know, resiliency we need to build for going to potentially impact cost? How do we do it in a way that makes sense, you know, for low income people and for, you know, the environment going forward? So, you know, I think all those issues really come together.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a question for both. We'll start with Elena. Who do you think needs to be involved in making a climate resilient community prepared? And what can community members do about climate?
I mean, I think one could argue that there's a role for everybody. An area that I found particularly compelling is moving beyond just the planning phase. A lot of communities have stepped up to the plate and drafted what are called vulnerability assessments, and they sort of clue in a community as to what are our problems, what are our specific climate-related problems. Mm-hmm. But once those plans are written, they can just sit on a shelf and collect dust. And so I think a place where community members can really perhaps shake the tree a little is to take a look at those vulnerability assessments yourself. Look at what, oftentimes they drill down to a community level, and you could see what are the impacts that are going to happen to my home and my favorite neighborhood, and go, there's usually actions identified in it that oftentimes should be spearheaded by a community member.
Anything to add, Isaac?
Yeah, I think that's really important because it is hard sometimes at the local level, at the ground level, to have the resources to, you know, do that kind of forward-looking analysis. So, you know, that kind of resource, that kind of collaboration is really helpful. I mean, a lot of people, you know, just with this recent flooding episode are kind of throwing up their hands. What do we do, you know, going into the future, you know, besides, you know, maybe tweaking the codes and any new construction, being more resilient, what can we really do? And I think, you know, that kind of thing is really important to involve the community in figuring out what some longer-term solutions are.
And oftentimes the kind of adaptation strategies that are suggested have multiple co-benefits, we call them. So one could be, on the one hand, improving the ability for your town to absorb rain in these really heavy rainstorms so that you don't have as much flooding, but it's also a beautiful town park. Or it's also, it turns into a beautiful marsh when it rains. So there are benefits that I think lots of different stakeholders can get excited about in terms of some of the adaptation ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've talked a little bit about Greater Boston. Elena, can you tell us about how New England as a region is doing in terms of climate adaptation and preparedness?
I think New England has actually made a lot of great strides in terms of identifying what are our unique problems with regard to climate change. We've been able to narrow it down, so we know that in New England, water, too much of it, at a very in very short periods of time is really one of our big problems. These are called cloudburst events, when you just have severe, heavy rainstorm, a lot of rain falling all at once, really in a short period of time. That's a pretty new phenomenon, and something that we know is going to be dramatically increasing in New England is really going to be one of our big problems. We've also identified Lyme disease and other vector-borne illnesses as something that will become more and more of a pressing issue for us. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of regionally setting ourselves apart and saying, okay, drought might not be our problem. We do still experience some drought in the summer, but predominantly we have identified water as something that we're going to really need to grapple with. So I'd say that's a good thing for New England and something that we can really work as a region on mm-hmm. together.
And it seems like there are some different issues depending on where in New England you are. I mean, I know, so Elena's joining us from the Vermont office. I know you were in Vermont during Hurricane Irene. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like and what some of the lessons learned were?
Yeah, so I stand in a really interesting place because I get to work on Boston-related climate issues where it's sea level rise, sea level rise, sea level rise. But in Vermont, there is no sea, right? There's the big lesson we learned in Hurricane Irene, or it was actually a tropical storm, was the power of our rivers. Our rivers themselves turned into hurricanes and literally ripped off buildings from their foundations that were right up against the river. And we learned that with the topography in Vermont, the hilly topography, all the water from those cloudburst events that I just talked about rush into our rivers, and we've built up our floodplains around our rivers to such a great extent that we stand very vulnerable, like sitting ducks waiting for that next storm. So we really have had to drill down on what are we doing in our river corridor, in our riverbeds, because just like Isaac was saying about low-income housing going in where there's more flood opportunity. Unfortunately, many of Vermonters' lower-income populations do live in areas right along the river. So that was a lesson we learned from Irene. We also learned, though, that Vermonters are really, really resilient people, and it was very powerful to see the way that neighbors rallied for each other, and you know, there's a new license plate created, Vermont Strong. 5 years later, 6 years later, I still see those license plates driving around Vermont, and people know what it means, and they know that, you know, we're ready to help each other out in times of need like that.
And so what significant changes have taken place since Irene that you think might better prepare Vermont for the next type of event like that?
Well, sticking with rivers, one thing that the state did was actually map out an area along the river that we really should not be developing mm-hmm. so that we can make better informed decisions about where we're putting our investments and trying to put them out of harm's way. Because the more that the river can access its floodplain, the more it can slow down. And that's really where a lot of the destruction happened, was because of the veracity of the water.
And what was CLF's role in that work?
CLF has taken those maps and is working on trying to create a incentive structure or some sort of legislative mandate for towns to actually better incorporate that information into their planning processes. Because unfortunately, when push comes to shove, oftentimes, unless it's a mandate or in statute, voluntary measures only go so far. Mm-hmm. So we're working on trying to find that sweet spot of how do you incent people not to build in the right place through carrots versus when does the stick come in.
And this question is for both of you, but we'll start with Isaac. Who do you think needs to be pushed, and what can we do to push them to make our communities more climate ready?
I think it's a question of, you know, how do you sort of coalesce the right set of constituencies? So in Lynn, you know, an interesting note is that a big piece of the flooding, or in any case, a factor in the flooding, is this longstanding issue with the sewer and storm drains being connected. And, you know, this goes back decades. This is something that should have been resolved. You know, there's funding issues, there's management issues, there's planning issues. And it just happens that, you know, it tends to be in Lynn, particular set of mostly lower income, you know, neighborhoods that are worst impacted by this. And, you know, somehow this hasn't gotten resolved, you know, despite the efforts of a lot of local people on the ground. So I think it's, you know, sort of bringing those on the ground issues together with, you know, housing, with these other, you know, problems that people see as really pressing, and connecting them in a clear way to climate resiliency so that, you know, people can kind of build the coalition we need, right? Because these, you know, these issues and people's lived experience all mesh together.
Yeah.
You know, income inequality, you know, racism, housing, you know, crises, all these things, you know, come together very much. I mean, you know, I remember working with a family that came very close to losing their home to foreclosure because flood insurance was too expensive.
Mm.
And the new FEMA maps a couple years back, you know, included them in there.
Yep.
The lender wasn't working with them. It was a predatory loan. So all these things, you know, sort of came together.
Yeah.
And it didn't mean that, you know, they shouldn't have been, you know, required to have some kind of provision for flooding. But, you know, it's just you can't abstract one issue from the other. So I think, you know, bringing those issues together is really important. You know, another example of that is the Wheelabrator coal ash landfill, which is, you know, right over the border from Landon-Saugus. It's on the water, all kinds of toxic stuff in there. And instead of moving towards closure, they're now moving towards expanding it.
Yep.
So, you know, neighbors of that area may see that as a really pressing issue. Obviously, it's related to climate justice and sea level rise, because flooding of that area is going to become more prevalent as that goes forward. So I think, you know, bringing the here and now issues that might not be directly climate change related into
yeah.
contact with those things, that's what's going to build, you know, the kind of constituencies we need to push for change on lots of different levels.
Absolutely. That's a really good point.
I would say, you know, there are so many different pressure points in terms of at the local level, state level, federal level, and on different topics, whether it's this insurance, flood insurance issue, whether it's flooding issue more generally. But I think what I would say is the messenger is very important, who that messenger is. And there is such a need for local people who are living these experiences to be talking about them and to be telling your local representatives and state representatives about your experience of climate change, because CLS is at the state level, at the state house,
yeah.
you know, litigating these issues if necessary. But it's so important for the individual voices to be heard.
Mm-hmm. I just want to remind people that you can call in with questions by pressing *1 on the phone. You can also post questions on Facebook. We'll be opening up the Q&A soon. On that point, Elena, in terms of, you know, especially in terms of putting pressure on public officials, I just want to make a plug for legislation that's currently pending in Massachusetts that CLF is advocating for as part of the Massachusetts Adaptation Coalition. It's called CAMP, stands for Comprehensive Adaptation Management Plan. And this bill would do a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of providing municipalities resources to do vulnerability assessments, technical assistance, some implementation money, and really kind of codifies in Massachusetts state law the urgency of a lot of these issues, which we just don't have right now. So everyone listening on the phone, I would encourage you to look into that legislation, and if you agree that it's a good thing for Massachusetts, call your legislature and really urge them to support it.
I would say another thing that is probably going to be a repeat over and over again is funding and how we're going to pay for mm-hmm. the price tag that comes along with the types of adaptation strategies yeah. that need to be deployed. And so oftentimes that is something that gets voted on. And it's important for everyone to understand the notion of, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That very much applies to hazard mitigation. So we know that every dollar we spend on preventing these kinds of disasters, we save $5 to $6 that we would spend later just cleaning up the mess.
Absolutely.
Not to mention the loss of human life. I mean,
yep.
it's not just about money.
And well, to Isaac's point, I think that in kind of framing the cost of adaptation, it's really important to think about it holistically with all of these other things. So as we're upgrading critical infrastructure and other systems, just taking into consideration climate change is kind of, you know, killing two birds with one stone. So I think that framing is really important. So I think we're going to open up the line for questions. We have one question from Mary Gilbert.
My question is, what is the number of that bill? I've been following what I thought was practically all of the relevant legislation in Massachusetts, and I don't know the one you're talking about.
Oh, I actually don't know the number of the bill off of the top of my head. I know there's one in the House and the Senate. We're going to try and find that for you.
Is it the bill that also has been called the Global Warming Solutions Implementation Act and
no.
just got renamed the Green Energy Roadmap?
No, so that's actually a different bill.
Okay.
This one's called CAMP, yeah, C-A-M-P.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. Hopefully we'll have the number for you. This is a good test of our staff to see how quickly they can insert the name of the bill and find the number.
Oh.
Yes, okay, so it's Senate Bill 472.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
Okay, we have a question on Facebook Live. How do we make sure our current homes are safe from all of these storms? It's a great question. Elena, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, something that we've been advocating for here at CLF is for just the same way that you might get your home energy audit to try and figure out how to save electricity and save money to do different things to your house to make it more energy efficient. There are some companies that are starting to do resiliency audits. It's kind of a newer thing, but that is something that you can look into, and certainly is a growing item that people are asking for, because unfortunately, a lot of the flood maps that our flood insurance relies on are government-issued maps that are very old and outdated. And so just whether or not you are in the floodplain is not sufficient to determine whether you really are at risk. Massachusetts is actually working on pretty granular level data that maybe, Deanna, you can talk about a little bit more that goes almost down to the neighborhood scale.
Yeah, so a lot of the cities and towns in Massachusetts have been doing these types of vulnerability assessments and data collection for a few years now, and Boston was the most recent one to come out with a really granular data set that shows, you know, future risks, folks that will be in the floodplain that aren't today and things like that. But Massachusetts as a state is undergoing a process to collect data and provide projection data for future impacts statewide. And that's part of implementation of Governor Baker's Executive Order 569, which requires cities and towns to be doing these types of vulnerability assessments and eventually putting money into implementation.
I mean, and I would also just say, in terms of the resilience in the broader sense of how well can you withstand a power outage if a big storm comes through, thinking about alternative sources of energy and trying to perhaps consider battery storage from solar panels or other alternatives so that, you know, you can be still safe and healthy even if the power goes out mm-hmm. for a while.
And at the community level, Isaac, what would you say to people who are concerned about flood impacts that they either saw during the last storm or they're going to be seeing more frequently? What are kind of the on-the-ground, day-to-day impacts that people are dealing with?
I think it's the same things we've been seeing for a while, but worse and more frequent. We've saw people this previous episode, you know, if they lose a boiler or two, if it's a two-family house, hot water heaters, all of a sudden $30,000, gone. So I think it really is an important example of, you know, planning ahead and trying to be proactive, like you mentioned. But I also think it's really important to recognize the limits of that sort of house by house, approach to it. you know, we've got to look much longer term and much broader scale, or, you know, otherwise, you know, it's not, first of all, we're not going to deal with the kind of underlying issues, but also it's just going to end up exacerbating, you know, income inequality and all these other things, right? So if someone has, you know, a multi-million dollar vacation house near the coast, you know, they can probably afford to, you know, lift the thing, you know, as much as is necessary. People in lower income areas, you know, we can't afford that. And, you know, if we're not going to just get pushed out of, you know, these areas, there really needs to be collective, you know, solutions, whether that's municipal level, state level, and beyond, that kind of are proactive going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to remind people that they can ask questions by pressing star one on the phone or posting on Facebook Live. I think we have another question in the queue from Facebook. In what ways can New England state leaders work together to address mitigation and adaptation on a regional basis? Helena?
Yeah, again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, in that we do have some shared climate impacts among the states in New England that it's worthwhile learning from each other. Mm-hmm. And so I think working at a regional level is important. For example, Massachusetts, the Executive Order 569 that you mentioned is a really great example of what a state can do to compel more adaptation efforts. Mm-hmm. And Rhode Island actually recently also passed an executive order that deals with climate change mitigation and resilience. And, you know, I'm not sure how much coordination there really was between the two states. It seems to me that that is perhaps a need that needs to be filled a little bit more than it currently is. We do plan regionally for things like ocean planning in New England, but there is some reticence that CLS has perceived of the New England states working as much together on things like climate change, because there are really different impacts when you drill down into specific places. And so setting standards at a regional level may not work the same way that we can set standards for or goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. When you get to adaptation, it's harder to set those shared standards. Mm-hmm. But I'd say working together, we can learn best practices and examples. And also, just if there's only one actor out front that's perhaps perceived as progressive, it could be helpful to work regionally and band together so that no one's out there alone up front.
Yeah. We have another question via email. How do we pay for the changes to infrastructure that are required?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I think I would run for office. I think that actually I've been thinking about this a lot, because in Vermont, actually, it is the hot topic in the legislature right now is trying to come up with a long-term funding mechanism specifically for clean water improvements, but a lot of rolled into that are, you know, impacts and support for climate adaptation strategies. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is undoubtedly a role for the private sector that is untapped right now, not only for the kinds of public-private partnerships that already exist, where, let's say, the private company funds the actual construction of the project and then slowly gets paid back by user fees or whatever, but also just straight out private investment. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I think, low-hanging fruit there and ripe opportunity for tapping into, in some cases, a community that hasn't really been paying their fair share of the impact that they are having on the climate mm-hmm. problems we're seeing, like flooding.
I think it's another, you know, case where just the extreme expansion of wealth inequality you know, over the past several decades is having an impact, where the tax burden over the past several decades has shifted dramatically from, you know, large corporations and very wealthy people onto middle and working class folks. And we're seeing that in, you know, the problems we're having with infrastructure across the board, a big part of that funding. So I think we need to address that as part of this. You know, that's the broader context that the lack of funds at this point to deal with climate change comes in. And I think you're starting to see pushback. So things like the Fair Share Amendment that's being pushed in Massachusetts to have a slightly more progressive tax structure at the state level, that's not targeted particularly at infrastructure or, climate resiliency, but I think it's a model for the kind of thing we need to start looking at. I mean, the money's just not there if we don't, grapple with that fundamental issue that, the people who are, in the corporations and the very wealthy who really have a huge amount of wealth and have been, monopolizing most of the gains in the economy, just aren't putting back in for the collective goods we all need. So, I think we've got to deal with that, or otherwise we end up, with situations where constituencies that should be allies on this begin to see this as an attack. So, something like, the new FEMA flood map that came out, people were outraged in Lynn. A lot of people, my house is, now in one of these flood zones, probably rightly so, but the day-to-day real impact of that is, how am I going to afford my mortgage and this really expensive flood insurance? So, we've got to grapple with those issues together. And, it's recently Martin Luther King Day, and I just have to throw the saying out there that Dr. King, was moving towards at the end of his life. He said, we're not going to solve some of these problems without a radical redistribution of economic and political power in this country. That's where he came to in terms of grappling with racism and militarism and economic inequality. And I think that's very much true in terms of climate justice, climate resiliency. If we want to solve these issues in a way that pushes us in a positive way towards the kind of world we want to see, it's going to be a real fight, and it's going to take a real pushback on, wealth inequality and unequal political power.
And on the flip side of that, I would say we also have an obligation to make sure that the money we do have, the little money we do have and how we're spending it, is climate smart.
Absolutely.
And so CLF has been working on state by state trying to enact provisions that would require states to basically do climate analysis before they spend money on spend state taxpayer dollars on new infrastructure to make sure that it's considering climate change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we have another question through Facebook. Who would you foresee as being liable for not preparing for climate impacts? Cities and utilities, or just building owners?
It depends on the situation, but I can say there are scenarios where all of the above could be on the hook for failing to adequately consider climate impacts when either designing a building, if you're the architect or the engineer, or to some extent, making a decision about whether or not to release water from a dam that ends up flooding a certain neighborhood if you're a government official. The after effects of the Houston flooding, right now there are, no pun intended, a flood of lawsuits have come in against the local government there for the decisions that were made right during and and before the rains really came down in terms of where waters would be released into certain neighborhoods. And there are a lot of interweaving laws that are at play, but I highly encourage you to read the report that came out yesterday. Has a legal primer and the beginning of it that is a great layperson's guide to some of the legal framework for liability that would fall on design practitioners or government officials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. We have a call on the phone. Mary Gilbert?
No.
No? Did you say hello?
No.
Mary, are you there?
Well, Mary Gilbert does not have a question.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Our bad.
We're going to go back to Facebook Live where there are more questions. Do you have any more advice on how to tie long-term concerns to the here-and-now problems for organizations that are working on this at a very local level and in low-income, diverse neighborhoods?
It's a great question. you know, I'm going to punt a little bit and say, you know, it really depends on the particular community and situation. You know, I think effort is needed on both sides of the equation. So, you know, small local community groups like ours, like Lynn United, you know, we need to look out for these opportunities. And on the other hand, Conservation Law Foundation, other groups involved in environmental justice and climate change issues need to, you know, try to continue producing really accessible materials and reaching out. You know, I think we can all do more to build those relationships. And, you know, that it's sort of a new thing for us over the past couple years, just gradually getting more up to speed in these issues. But I think, you know, there are local issues that are very specific that are going to bring these larger concerns together. So for us in Lynn, you know, maybe it's the coal ash landfill that, you know, has an immediate health concern. It relates to environmental justice and climate change. You know, another thing I think is housing is obviously a really key issue that just naturally involves both of these issues that, you know, we're seeing all this housing develops in Lynn on the waterfront. You know, we're going to simultaneously push for inclusion of affordable housing in these new developments. And, you know, we don't want to see that affordable housing, you know, vulnerable to climate events. So, you know, we've got to, you know, push at the same time for resiliency in those designs. We need to push for resiliency so that the public spaces that we're fighting for, you know, don't get flooded every 2 days.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I think it really depends, you know, in the particular location. But I do think it requires, you know, some real effort on both ends of the spectrum. And it's too bad that at this point, you know, historically, there's been a little bit of a divide in many cases, you know, between what's seen as environmental justice and what's seen as relating to other more local issues. And, you know, it's going to take real effort to, and there's some great work already being done. You know, we're certainly not at all a leader in that. There's groups all over the country that are really bringing these issues together. And I think it's going to be a continued you know, kind of effort we need to both sides need to put in.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, I hope there should be someone in every conversation around climate change and adaptation and resilience that talks about the opportunities and the positive spin on things. And I just can't emphasize enough how important it is to sort of repeat that mantra because, you know, what's that phrase? You attract more flies with honey than vinegar. It is true, and it's very easy to slip into motivating people with the doomsday stories and with the, even CLF, we tend to say there's legal liability, and that is a lever to get people motivated. Don't you want to stay out of court? But there's a lot of opportunity and chance for us to rethink what does vitality look like and this economic redistribution of wealth notion, like, This is a lever to have that conversation. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, and can I just add, I mean, I think, you know, sort of looking longer term, the phrase green jobs, I think it's been put out there as a frame, and I think that's important. But to look at that more broadly, you know, what kind of, you know, economic structure do we want to see, you know, going into the future as we kind of build for the future, what kind of future are we building for? And, you know, there's one approach that would look at, you know, just trying to make what we have currently more resilient and not really interrogating, you know, while we're doing that, we also need to look at the kind of underlying social impacts. What kind of jobs are, you know, are there going to be going forward in these new industries that come out of climate resiliency? You know, do we want to be sort of agnostic on that and say, well, you know, the companies will fill that void and we need to have, you know, regulatory mechanisms to encourage, you know, retrofitting and better design, or do we want to take a more proactive approach and say, hey, you know, not only do we need, you know, these, you know, new capacities to build for climate resiliency, but we want to really take a stand on that and say these jobs that are going to be created should be union jobs. We should be really sure that, you know, racial justice is a lens that we're looking at, you know, these new pieces through. And, you know, it's not easy, but I think there's a huge gain that by taking a sort of more critical view, we can bring together different constituencies that are sort of left out in lots of different ways by the system we have now.
Absolutely. And bringing my rural Vermont lens into this conversation, too, we're thinking a lot about what the future of farming looks like in Vermont. There's a lot of climate implications that come with the kind of large-scale dairy farming that is happening right now, both in terms of water quality implications, but also the type of labor that's going on those farms. And so there's absolutely opportunity to rethink what kind of a resilient, climate-ready food system looks like, too, and in our urban areas as well. In Boston, are the main way that we get food into most of this metro area is through a food center that is at sea level.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about our food system is another key need in society that we should be thinking about.
Definitely. So we're going to take the last question. This one's coming in via email. Building for climate change resilience for waterfront communities is still recommended but not mandated, even major new development in places like Boston's waterfront. Is this a decision in which each community has latitude, and shouldn't building standards be standardized? How can CLF help push for that?
That was like a perfect tee-up for work that we're already doing. So one of the recommendations that we really decided upon after having a lot of conversations with experts, architects, and designers and planners around this region is that something at the building code, in order to be, it should be an effective building code, effective at protecting public health and safety. And that's really what it comes down to. And so we need to question whether the code as it's written is truly an effective code. Because a lot of the recommendations around becoming more, making your building more resilient are, as you say, questioner, just recommendations. And so we are engaged with, we're having a really interesting collection of people who are coming from all different sectors together to dive into that issue a little bit more. Every state does adopt certain components of an international building code, and Massachusetts in particular revisits those codes every couple of years. So there is an opportunity to engage and think strategically about whether there needs to be change.
Great. Anything to add?
That covers it.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us on the phone and on Facebook. I just want to remind people, if you want to learn more about what CLF is doing on these issues, you can go to our website, clf.org. You can sign up for e-news and find out more about how to get involved. So thank you, Elena and Isaac, for being here for a great discussion. Thank you, everyone, for their thoughtful questions, and see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.